said, everything I say is the same everywhere I am. Okay.
Good morning, everybody.
Morning.
I'm Jim Longer. I am Kirkland Mayor, and I welcome you again for what could be the final one of these in the series, but I think we may be looking at more because it's been, frankly, one of the best things that I've seen regionally organized and handled and attended in the time I've been on council. So this has really been outstanding. What I like about it most is that I come here, and even though I'm a student of all the things that happen ecologically, I just happen to like it. I learn something new all the time here because the terrain is moving all the time. Not the train, the terrain is moving all the time on things that are ecological, and we have to keep up to date. So I think this has done a great job, and my kudos to all those of you that have organized it and have moderated it. Talk a little bit about stormwater today, and what I'd like to do is just go back to a remark that I made last time, and that for policymakers, the key thing about stormwater and utilities that are under the ground is that we have this collision again of towns and cities that barely can put enough money together in revenues, in the declining revenue environment, to handle basic needs. And basic needs can be obviously police and fire, our roads. Parks in Kirkland are always looked at as a basic need, but certainly what's under the street, stormwater, sewer, and water delivery is a basic need for the citizens. And we barely have enough money budget-wise throughout the state or around anywhere in this country to handle the basic needs today. And so we really have to be thinking strategically and long-term in how we address those basic needs, not only in making sure they're funded with the right kind of fees up front for the future and replacement, but also in the types of things that we can do that you'll hear more about this morning in addressing issues of stormwater. When we think in terms of a policymaker, the one guiding principle that I've had in the time I've been on council is our key responsibility in Kirkland, in this town, is what we put into the lake, the water quality that goes into the lake. We have a salmon-bearing stream or two, and that's important, but the main thing, since we are in a hillside environment, is that everything that goes down into the lake, we should certainly like to make it cleaner. Early on, coming out of Planning Commission, going on council, I had the opportunity to tour with Jenny and others the Street Edge Alternatives, SEA streets over in Seattle. And that would be something I would hope that a city like Kirkland could get to in terms of not even using storm pipes. Be able to let that water go into a swale. We have a little bit of work to do with our neighborhoods first to let them get them accepting of this new design of sidewalks, as Seattle did. But if you look at the grid of streets over in the Greenwood area, about 104th going down to Piper's Creek, it is really instrumental in terms of a system that allows filtration rather than stormwater plummeting into the Sound and taking, is it Piper's Creek? Piper's Creek over there up 3-4 feet when a major storm happens, or the water quality. They've actually solved that through the SEA streets, and that would be a strategy, we may be touching on that today, that I'd certainly like to see Kirkland move to just as an idea of making a better policy for the long run and for the future. So, again, welcome. Enjoy the morning as you have before, and we'll get started with, who's going to start this? You want to start? Our moderator.
Good morning. Thank you so much, Jim. This has been wonderful to have Jim supporting this whole series and being able to bring sustainable site development to a lot of different people, so we're really happy to have you here. My name is Robin Rogers. I'm with the Sustainability Foundation, and we've been working with David to bring these to you. We've got four great speakers on the panel today. First, we're going to hear from Steve Foley, who is our resident King County expert on low-impact development and stormwater management. Steve is over here. He has been really instrumental in helping develop the guidelines and ordinances in our region that really are being adopted all over the country. We've been real up in the forefront throughout the country in developing these standards. And so Steve's going to share with you what's being developed. And then we are going to hear from Jenny Gauss with the City of Kirkland. She's a surface water utility engineer, and she's going to give us some examples of what's worked, and I think what hasn't worked, maybe, around the city of Kirkland, so right here in our own backyard. And then we're going to hear from Michael Moody with Triad Associates. They're a local firm working with low-impact development. He's going to show you some examples, some great examples of things that his firm has done and that's worked. And then we're going to hear from Linda Pruitt with the Cottage Company. Linda has also real-world examples of what's worked in the area. She's a developer who's worked on small communities. She designs and builds small communities that have been written up in the New York Times because of their timeliness and the fact that they work, and real market-based program also. So we are going to have questions addressed to Steve right after his talk, because Steve has to leave early. So if you have questions for him, I suggest that you get them in right at the end of his talk. And then the rest of the questions, we'll have a good question and answer period at the end. We want to particularly thank the Department of Ecology. They have funded this whole series. And we actually have a representative here, Vicki Colgan, who has worked for years with many of us in funding all these great programs. And she's been delightful to work with. And if you have any questions about what ecology is doing, especially in building and development, I suggest you find Vicki and ask her. So we're going to look at stormwater management. What role does development play in it? Big picture, and then also diving down into some of the details. What are some of the synergies and strategies for dealing with stormwater naturally? In all of these sessions, we've also mentioned different grading programs. Most of you probably are familiar with LEED or Built Green. Everybody? Yeah. So we won't really talk any more about that, but the resources are here if you want to go read more about them. They all have components of sustainable site development. And then there are also two specifically related site programs or site rating programs. The Sustainable Sites Initiative is a partnership between the American Society of Landscape Architects and the U.S. Green Building Council, and I think there may be several other groups that are involved in actually developing standards for sites. So it might be a park. You know, many of the other rating programs have to do with buildings, and this is really looking at the site as a whole. So a lot of the strategies and techniques that you'll hear about today are being incorporated into these. And of course, Audubon International has their sustainable communities and also golf course programs. So you already know I'm Robin. with the Sustainability Foundation. We are a small nonprofit dedicated to educating about green building and sustainable building and development practices. So I'm just going to give you like a 20,000 years compressed into a couple of minutes here. Just a slight introduction to what we're talking about. You know, in the beginning, we were covered with ice 20,000 years ago. There was a big glacier. When it retreated, it left kind of a big bathtub for us called Puget Sound. And you can see the drainage basin. And, you know, if you've ever been outside of anywhere, you know that we're all hills, and all the hills just drain right into Puget Sound. And it's a pretty big area. So what we're looking at, or what we were looking at, the forested conditions, you can see that 0.3% of the runoff actually reaches the streams and the lakes and the rivers under natural forested conditions. The rest of it is absorbed into the atmosphere through evapotranspiration or infiltrated into the ground, ideally. Of course, now we're looking at major deforestation. The top map shows in the 1600s, and then in the 1800s, and then in the 1920s. Did everybody see that? We are looking at major loss of forest, not just here, but all over the country. But even here, you can see all the brown patches are areas where we've lost the forest. Of the remaining forest, 80% of that is slated for logging in the Pacific Northwest. There's a direct relationship even to deforestation. This is just showing the east side. Deforestation on the left, and urbanization may not be as bad if we're deforesting but then replanting forests, but in our area, much of it is turning into urban areas. So under developed conditions, we're looking at 30% surface runoff as opposed to 0.3% before. So it's kind of a serious issue when much of this surface runoff is carrying things like soil with it. It's removing the vegetation along our stream side, stream banks and lake shorelines. Another one of the problems, when all of this surface runoff is flowing into the lakes and rivers and the sound, is pollution. We're looking at 150,000 pounds of untreated toxins flowing into the sound every single day. And every 2 years, I don't know if any of you heard this or saw this PBS show with Jay Manning. It was shocking, wasn't it, for me to hear 10, almost 11 million gallons of oil flowing into Puget Sound every 2 years. So anyway, apparently even the salmon are very desperate. And there are a lot of other problems that are being caused by the pollution and this runoff. So today, what we're going to hear from our four experts here are some of the solutions to these problems and how we might be able to deal with it and create better developments. Steve, you want to come on up? So please welcome Steve Boley.
So a lot of this is familiar to you, I'm sure. But what I'm going to do is give us a bit of a history of how we got here, and focus on King County standards since we've been one of the leaders in developing stormwater standards, and then talk a little more broadly about what else has gone on. And prior to 1975, I don't know what happened for stormwater. I mean, that was like dark ages. 75, we were probably all like about 3 or 13 or something like that. So we didn't know what was going on, but I think they just put in pipes and got rid of it and, didn't think about it too much. But then somebody got the idea that maybe we should do a better job of managing it and actually have some design standards. And in 1975, King County came out with a stormwater manual that required not just pipes, but also some kind of flow control. And the original standards in 75 and then updated in 79 resulted in a lot of small ponds that did something to attenuate flows. The designs were a theoretical basis that actually didn't match reality very well. But that was where we started, and things stayed that way for a long time. This was really advanced stuff, actually requiring some kind of detention to control peak flows. In 1990, we came out with a revolutionary idea that we might actually want to consider water quality and do some treatment through actual engineered facilities. This was pretty revolutionary in the 1990s. County manual was sort of recognized around the country as something pretty amazing. Around that time, or after that time, we got something called the National Pollution Discharge Elimination System, outgrowth of the Clean Water Act, and under that system, the Department of Ecology was delegated from the EPA to actually provide standards and guidance for stormwater, and the phase one jurisdictions, which were larger than 100,000. As of the 1990 census, we're actually required to have permits. And under the permit, one of the key things was people actually had to have stormwater control. And we'll talk a little bit more about what that meant and what's happened here in a minute. But anyway, 1998, King County updated its manual. What happened was with the 75-79 model, there was this artificial algorithm that said, this is what we think stormwater does, and this is how we control stormwater. Well, the model didn't represent reality very well. A more sophisticated model came out in 1990, along with our water quality facilities that were actually engineered designs. And that model did a little bit better job of representing reality, but the reality it represented was a single storm event and not what we have here, which is kind of ongoing rain, starting, stopping. And the result was those facilities built quite a bit larger than the previous standard, still didn't do a very good job of mitigating the runoff. In 1998, we said, well, what we really need is a model that's based on actual precipitation records. That's the continuous model, and that resulted in better mitigation. But the thinking, for the most part at the time, was what we need to do is match what the existing land condition is so that we're not aggravating the situation over what it is pre-development. But pre-development often meant some pasture rather than forest or some single family that became commercial, that sort of thing. And in 1998, we developed more sophisticated water quality modeling and a variety of new facility types and more targeted towards specific pollutants and protecting particular resources. And that was good. That represented an improvement. And then along comes ESA and the Chinook listing. Oh my God, we're losing salmon. All this development we think is having a big impact, and maybe we need to do a better job of mitigating that development. And in fact, we updated our manual again in 2005 in response to that. I'll talk about that a little more in a minute as well. But modeling, saying what we really need to be considering is fish and what they're adapted to is forested conditions, so that needs to be our hydrologic standard. And that was the new paradigm then, but at the same time we also said, well, with this LID thing, we'll incorporate some of that. We'll talk about that in a minute as well. And meantime, we have another round of NPDES permits, and these are not just for phase one, but now for phase two, so the stormwater thing is becoming much more important to everybody, not just the big jurisdictions. And we've done another minor update to our manual here in 2009. So as I was saying, we realized, King County realized, in the process of studying salmon streams, that the earlier mitigation was not adequate. We weren't doing a good enough job with our engineered facilities at protecting streams just from erosion, let alone other kinds of habitat degradation. The NPDES permit required that people start doing this stuff. Well, what the requirement was it had to be equivalent to the ecology manual. 1992 ecology came out with a manual that was essentially the 1990 King County manual. And a few years later did a major update to their standards as well. We're kind of leapfrogging 1990 King County, 92 ecology, 98 King County, 2001 ecology, 2005, both of us gave just a little before they. But anyway, with the Chinook listing, we had this prohibition on take, and the response to that was the Tri-County group, which included the three major counties, plus got developers on board and other jurisdictions, to say, what can we do? We don't want to so let's come up with the best ideas we can. And one of the ideas was that everybody should be doing stormwater control that's equivalent to the 2001 DOE manual, and that manual was sort of the next step beyond, which based the flow control on forest conditions. We have a new permit now, but anyway, while all this is going on, we're realizing as well that yes, these engineered systems are doing a better job of controlling flow and dealing with water quality, but they're not addressing all the hydrologic impacts. About 10 years ago, we got more aware of that and hearing about this low impact development idea that was being used in some other parts of the country. In 2001, we had a conference with about 500 people attending here, and that really got the ball rolling a whole lot. King County, we had a demonstration ordinance. We had some demonstration projects in 2003, 2005. We got the Puget Sound LID manual, which was a whole alternative paradigm, which we're going to talk about a lot more in a few more minutes. But another response to this listing and reorganization of the Puget Sound Action Team for the Puget Sound Water Quality Authority is the Puget Sound Partnership, and group of scientists who were involved in the partnership came out and said, look, LID is the way to go. We really need to have more LID. The 2007 NPDES permits were issued, which didn't really require LID, and the appeals to the Puget Sound Pollution Control Hearings Board resulted in a ruling that said you need to incorporate LID into the NPDES permit, which is an ongoing process. In response to that, a lot more people in more jurisdictions started looking at the use of LID, and over the last few years, there's been a proliferation of ordinances and demonstration projects, some of them grant-funded, some of them public-private partnerships, and some of them pretty much done just by the developers themselves. So, the way we're managing stormwater has changed considerably. And in addition to stormwater manuals and engineered facilities, at the same time we have our critical areas ordinances, which are an integral part of managing stormwater. So we're not just building facilities, we also have to set areas aside, buffers, limit the amount of clearing, amend soils. There are a lot of techniques that can be a part of preserving the forested sort of hydrology that we want to see. And in addition, we have stormwater programs that include capital projects, maintenance, planning, and all of that sort of thing. So stormwater manuals and regulations and what we do to control runoff from development are just a part of the big picture, just trying to give you the context on that stuff. So in stormwater manuals themselves require review of projects that exceed thresholds, and you're looking at downstream resources, flooding problems, that sort of thing, and designing a stormwater system to mitigate those things. And we've talked about flow control as far as flooding and erosion and water quality treatment. Also, erosion control during construction and maintenance of these facilities is also an integral part of the stormwater management picture. And our current manuals require not only heights or swales and flow control or water quality treatment facilities, but we're also now requiring the use of LID BMPs. We encourage people to go as far as they can or as far as they're willing to, but at a minimum, we require the use of some of those BMPs now on all projects. And in addition to the structural BMPs, either the LID BMPs that are going to be discussed and the ponds, we also have pollution prevention practices. We actively educate and go out and look at commercial sites good housekeeping practices, preventing spills or cleaning up spills, not using toxic materials in the first place. So anyway, that's kind of where we have been and where we are now. Next speakers are going to talk about what these actual LIBFTs are and what some of the projects that have been done in the local area look like. Do you have any questions of me before I take off? Yeah?
How intense and hard was it to go through the public process of getting people on board and accepting Keeley?
Well, it's been going on for a long time, and certain processes were more difficult than others. Like, for instance, the critical areas ordinance stuff that happened in the early 90s was very controversial. Getting our 1998 manual in place was a very long process, working with the council and the master builders, other interested stakeholders. So really a lot of time in getting people on board and not just trying to sell it to people, but getting input from people who are actual design engineers on how easy or feasible or costly what we were doing was. So we did a lot of cost analysis to look at the cost impact of the requirements. Since the ESA listing, it's been a lot easier to upgrade the standards. There's been much more recognition that this is a real problem and we just have to do it. So since that time, less of an issue. But LIB in particular is involved in a lot of government, a lot of education, a lot of hand-holding and a little bit of pushing. It's been a challenge. Yeah?
It seems to me the challenge is as we continue to densify and urbanize and fill, is that competing with LIB that takes on a more impervious surface?
It is a problem. We talk about smart growth and being able to have development, but the fact is, we at this point, I don't think are 100% successful at mitigating impacts. In many cases in the past, we haven't been anywhere near close. So I think as growth continues, then we're going to have more impacts and work the best we can. But there is a fundamental conflict between growth and protecting resources. It's a lot easier to incorporate LIB into new development than it is into that's a good question. Most of this stuff has not been out there for very long, and it's one thing to put something in a manual, and another to get it on a plan, another to get it built, and yet another to get somebody care enough to maintain it or not eliminate it. So we are just starting our program of inspection of these single-family residential
what are the patterns before you start to try to require or encourage 6, and the allowable lot coverage is about 50% for residential lots. So you can see that there's a lot of area covered by rooftops and pavement and whatnot in this picture. In addition, all of the stormwater is piped, it's underground. The stormwater facility is for this plat. Oh, there we go. It's all piped down to this underground tank. One thing that's kind of unique about Kirkland is that until 1998, surface water ponds were actually prohibited by our city code. We also had a public works director at some point that didn't like ponds, and so all of our facilities are underground up until 1998. And so out of about 800 facilities, we have maybe 60 ponds total. And so the result of that is the stormwater has really been out of sight, out of mind. The other thing pushing this is that land cost is very high, and so giving land, taking up land with stormwater facilities was really not an option when that land was worth so much. So all of this leads to, perhaps here in Kirkland, things such as green roofs or permeable pavement might be more applicable than rain gardens or other things that might take up more space. So these are four ways that, or four items with which the city can influence low impact development. They kind of span a spectrum from allowing LID to encouraging it to requiring it. As Steve mentioned, King County has come out with now a 2009 update of their surface water design manual. Kirkland will be proposing to our city council this summer an update to our design regulations that's equivalent to the Department of Ecology manual. That's a requirement under our permit. And that manual will help to encourage and, in some sense, require LID in that all small sites will be asked to look at on-site stormwater management as feasible. Of course, there's a lot of discussion about what exactly as feasible means, feasible for who and for what. So that's a big point of discussion. But at least it's in there. And then the way that the new design manual provides incentives for LID is that the required facility sizes for some types of sites are much larger. And so LID becomes a more attractive option because it can allow you to reduce the size, or perhaps if you're really lucky, you might be able to eliminate your underground facilities altogether by using LID. If you want to get involved in that process, you can go to our city website, type stormwater update in the search box, and there's a whole bunch of documents that St. Brush has produced. And again, that will be coming before our city council sometime in the summer. For land use and zoning, we have made some strides. In 2008, the city passed the cottage housing ordinance, and this allows for clustering of small attached and detached houses, and also includes the provision that LID must be used for stormwater management. And it's really one of our best chances, clustering is one of our best chances to get LID to work, because it leaves more space for tree retention and for open spaces, grass, and other LID facilities and surface facilities. So it's a great stride forward, and we hope to see that used. Danielson Grove, which Mike Moody will talk about next, includes a lot of LID features. That was constructed as pilot project as a part of a tool as you're looking at your soils, allows you to more accurately do your designs. And the folks at the UW have used all of this geologic exploration data to develop the new soils map for Kirkland. That map will be complete in about a month, and we'll have a lot more publicity about it. But you get to see it here first. Here's a preview of what will be different for the map. So this is, you guys are it. This is it. So on the left here is the 1983 geologic map, shows just two units, pretty simple. On the right is an example of what the new map will look like. A lot more detail, a lot more information about your soils. I can't do it justice because I'm not a geologist, but some of the things that are important are the type of glacial till that you have, whether it's landslide material or not, you know, other factors about it really influence exactly what will happen with your infiltration rate. Geologic data, and then did some, my understanding is they did 3D modeling using that, and then they also did field work. So they were out looking, whenever we had a large foundation dig in Kirkland, they would come out and take a look at it. We actually went out on a boat about 2 weeks ago to look at some of the formations along the lake shore. So they did a combination of the geologic exploration and other data. So next, I want to just point out that LID is one part of an overall surface water management. Again, there's very little land left to develop in our city. Most of it is already developed, so things like retrofit of watersheds, whether that happens on the public or the private side, education and outreach, maintenance and operations are all key to healthy watersheds. And LID can play a big role in that, but it does need these other things to make the whole picture work. Finally, I'd like to talk a little bit about cultural change. And I think there's been a lot of resistance to LID because it looks very different. It's at the surface, which in Kirkland hasn't happened. Just how can we sort of make LID the norm? I think it's important to respond to communities in doing your design and to listen to the wants and the needs, but LID is also about sort of slowly trying to change that norm. And so this is a demonstration rain garden that was constructed at the Forbes House in Juanita Beach Park. Trying to get the word out there, including our mayor, thank you, for volunteers helping to plant the rain garden. And there's an interpretive sign so people can try to go and learn about that and recreate it in their own yard. It's important to highlight the successes. We had a group of students at the UW develop a brochure with a tour of LID sites to try to, again, highlight those successes. Internally, we've also reviewed all of our transportation capital projects for LID. Come up with ways that LID might be put into those so that when a project engineer starts working with a new designer, a new design firm that may not be familiar with LID, they have sort of a starting point and say, here's some ideas for how we might do this. Finally, I think people need to have more fun with stormwater. I mean, kids sort of know this intrinsically. They're out stomping around in puddles, you know, when it rains. I think we've maybe forgotten that as adults. And, view stormwater as sort of a waste product. And if we start to view stormwater as more of a resource, as something that could really be part of our communities, I think we'll be better off. This is an example of Ben Franklin Elementary where water comes down off the roof, bounces on these rocks, and then into the infiltration facility here. It's really beautiful. It's really a lot of fun to watch. The city of Portland actually has a really excellent tour of art that involves rainwater. And so I think that starting to shift that mindset that water is something that's a good part of our communities can really help. So now I'm going to turn it over to Mike Moody to talk about some real life examples.
Associates here in the city of Kirkland. I'm on the sustainable development team internally to Triad, where we have landscape architects, planners, and engineers on the team. And we're constantly looking at opportunities both real projects and potential projects where we can apply sustainable development techniques. I will be continuing our discussion today from my perspective as a design engineer, and specifically about the shift from the conventional approach, which has been to collect and convey all of the stormwater on the development site into a single facility, a large pond or vault with a one-point discharge, to a more sustainable approach that intends to use microsystems spread out across the site to better mimic the natural hydrologic cycle. And I'll give some examples as we go. Specifically, I'll cover four stormwater-specific LID techniques that we have been using or are available to us, the challenges associated with those techniques, some lessons learned from applying them to real projects, and Colleen will walk through a case study. First, the LID techniques. There are four I'd like to cover: fire retention, permeable pavement, rainwater harvesting, and green roofs. For fire retention, there are two types of fire retention facilities: rain gardens and swales, or ponds and vaults. And in each case, they have the same four components in their design. There is a soil mix here at the base level. That would be essentially an amended soil, unless you have really good high permeability native soil. Then you have a storage depth for water that's maximum 12 inches. So this is different from our ponds that can get up 6-8 feet. Then we have vegetation, and finally a drain to prevent flooding. It could be an under drain or some kind of standpipe at the top of our storage. An example, this is Shamrock Heights. Steve Foley mentioned it. This is the rain garden on site. It's a fairly large one, actually, where it's actually managing stormwater from several of the lots on site. And this is early stages of construction. And it's the same rain garden after it's been constructed. You can see the houses in the background. It's fully functioning. This project has just begun the monitoring process. And it's been going on for a couple months now. So we're just now getting some of the data for that to find out how it's performing. Just by observation over the last couple years, it's been performing quite well. This is the same project. This is a swale now, in early stages, fire retention swale in early stages of construction. And this is later on in construction. A point I'd like to make here is that the fire retention facility, assuming you have the area for it, is built well, can actually add an aesthetic value as well. This is a lot nicer looking than a typical ditch would be, even a grass-lined ditch. That brings us to our second LID technique, permeable pavement. There are four primary categories of this: concrete, asphalt, pavers, and plastic grids. A typical mix, this is what we call the Rice Krispies mix for permeable concrete. And you can see it functioning here with primarily voids in the mix to allow water to permeate through it. There are other mixes, however, because there are some challenges with building this and then having it function. So there are other mixes. This one is called Percocrete. It functions just as well, if not better, than the Rice Krispies mix. It's also concrete. Looks closer, has a closer look to the conventional concrete. This is a permeable asphalt. You see, here's the permeable asphalt right next to a conventional asphalt. These are pavers, two different types of pavers. The difference here is with the grass pave or grass creek type of paver, you have a larger void in the center for planting grass, and this is the drivable surface. These are the plastic grids compared to the pavers. Plastic grids here and here, before installation and after installation, and then your pavers here and here. What I like to point out here is that although there is an additional cost associated with the plastic grids, the post-construction look is a little bit better. You don't actually see the grids here like you see the pavers down here. This concludes permeable pavement. One other thing I wanted to actually mention here about permeable pavement, I'll mention a little bit further on when we get to the case study, that these are pavement types of permeable surfaces. There are other permeable surfaces that have been around for years. Gravel, for example, is fantastic. and we'll get to that. We can use that as well as a loan package development tool for stormwater management. I'll show an example of that later. Our third LAM technique is rainwater harvesting. There are a lot of questions involving the permitting and legality of using this. However, from our management perspective, it's highly effective. The intent is to catch and reuse stormwater for other uses on site. And these other uses are listed in order of increasing difficulty. Irrigation, pretty simple. All you need is an above-ground cistern, gravity-fed into a vegetated area. The potable uses, which would be something you could use for drinking. Now we have to add pumps and power supplies and filters. It's a little more difficult, but it is effective. Here's a schematic here and a real example of the potable type of use for rainwater harvesting. An underground cistern that has filter, and then inside there would be another filter to pump back into the house for potable uses. And you see the pump and the controller, and there's a pressure valve there as well. This is a simplified type of design. It's just an above ground cistern where it can be gravity fed into an irrigation area, or where you could maybe use it for washing cars or something. And the final LED technique we'll discuss today is green roofs. Widespread use in Europe since the 50s. Isolated uses even into the 19th century. It's just gaining some steam here in the U.S. over the last 5-6 years. They're comprised of a growing media and plants. This is an engineered soil mix because it's going on a roof. Their typical soil is pretty heavy, so that the structure can't really handle it. So we engineer a soil mix for that. They're specifically chosen plants that can handle the environment on a roof. It's a pretty tough environment on the roof, even in this region. So it needs to be grasses and cedars and stuff that can handle that. We have some examples here. I should probably change the slide. I believe it's, Monday? Something's going to be officially chased now. But this is the Wambu building downtown Seattle. It's fairly high-end, largely aesthetic values here. You have some ground or some shrubs here and some trees, so the soil mix is going to be pretty thick here, 24 inches to maybe 36. I'm not sure. I didn't see the details on this one. A somewhat lower end, but still functioning, is the Justice Building. You see a lot of sedums here and some grasses again. And then here the soil mix will be more like 6 inches to 8 inches. Residential uses. Here, fairly simple. Actually, let's go back to this one, because right here you can see these are trays. You order the trays right from whoever's going to supply this to your site. They come ready to install. You just have to prepare the roof, and there's a little bit of work to just prepare the roof. But it is a fairly simple installation. These ones are about 50 pounds each, so it can be a challenge. Notice here it's not easily accessible, so there can be a challenge with installation, but it is functional. And to get into the challenges, because all of these techniques, although great in theory, have challenges with implementing them in the design and then constructing them and maintaining them. So to discuss some of those, on the design side, there are three primary challenges. One is the soil, another is topography, and then site plan. Soils, when you're using bioretention or permeable pavement, it's the higher the permeability of your soil, native soil, the greater flexibility you have with those techniques. This region, we have a lot of the glacial tills, which have a low permeability generally, so it increases the challenge with designing those and implementing them. It can work, but you don't have as much flexibility. Topography. Any of the projects, even in a conventional approach, can have a challenge with super flat or super steep sites. We live in a hilly region, so there are a lot of steep areas. A rain garden, which needs lots of area and needs to hold 12 inches of water, is not going to stand very well on a slope. The site plan. If the site plan has been designed with the conventional approach in mind, then you could end up wanting to implement LID and you lose some of your usable area because you need some area for these tools. The regulations. The design, the innovation of the designs is typically ahead of the regulations that the codes and standards that regulate these. So there can be a challenge, because if I say rain garden, maybe the code doesn't have a rain garden. construction, don't have a lot of experience with these yet, so the new methods, new materials, critical sequencing involved with constructing them can also be a challenge. And fine performance. We're assuming a performance in the design still because we don't have much data to calibrate a real model. Lessons learned, design collaboration. It's important early on in the design phase to partner with the municipal staff, contractors, landscape architects, so that we're all on the same page right in the early on stages, so that when we get to the semantics, when I say bioswale, some people might think of a biofiltration soil, some people think of bioretention soil. What is it? The entire team, which includes municipal staff, needs to know when I say bioswale, what does that mean? Scope of application. I mentioned this earlier. We can't just have one large rain garden, and that's our LID technique for the site. It's cost prohibitive. You need a lot of area for that, and it just doesn't work very well. So you need smaller systems, small rain gardens, some swales, some perennial pavement applied throughout the whole site, and that works a lot better. Contractor participation, again, we need the contractor to be involved early on so he or she is aware this is what we're doing. So if we have a permeable parking lot or a pad somewhere, in phase one they don't go and clear it all out, come back the whole thing, and now we can't use it for permanent payment. That has happened. This brings us to the case study, Danielson Grove. This is a City of Kirkland project, about 2.5 acres. Well, we implemented quite a few impact development techniques from a stormwater perspective, beginning with retaining trees. In these areas, there are trees that were retained and associated native vegetation for that area. It's a very effective as stormwater management tool. And then in between each of the homes, we have bioretention swales. I'll show you some pictures of these as we get further on. And then impervious paving, you see here there's paths here, path here, and parking here that was pervious paving. All of this combined led to a smaller detention vault. And here's where I mentioned the gravel. This is in lieu of a typical concrete sidewalk for the road through the site, we used on one side a gravel sidewalk. Here's the permeable paving path through the native vegetation, and there's our grasscrete parking. These are the bioretention swales. Notice how narrow they are, but highly functioning with the specifically designed soil and plants. It carries the roof water from the back to the front and then into the detention vault. Speaking of detention vault, we were able to uniquely locate the vault so that it actually sits under this patio and the commons building. Fairly atypical to place a vault under a structure like a building like that. But it helps reduce the development footprint, and we'd already reduced the area of the vault. And I'll conclude with this case study with showing a cost comparison of the vault itself, the detention vault. From a conventional perspective, it would have been a 14,000 cubic foot detention vault. But the actual design was a low impact development after we earned some credits for reducing the effective impervious area. We ended up with 8,100 cubic feet. For a cost savings of about 42%, this is an in-place construction cost, just the vault. An important note to make here is that this, as a project cost savings, is reduced to somewhere between 30 and 35% when you include the increased cost associated with permitting, construction, and then maintenance. But overall, it was highly successful, and as a project, did see cost savings. And this brings me to the end of my portion, and I'd like to bring Linda.
Thank you, Michael. So in introducing Linda, the project that Michael just talked about, Danielson Grove, that is one of Linda's projects that she helped to build.
it really does help me in thinking about what innovative approaches we might want to explore in other jurisdictions by being able to say, well, you know, we did this in Kirkland, and, oh, yeah, I heard about that, or I went to a seminar about that, or, you know, we've been excited to try and try some of those things. And it gives great credibility and great education. I really appreciate the role that Kirkland has served to embrace the kind of change that we all look for in a more sustainable development future and in creating real community. So thank you, all you City of Kirkland folks. The Cottage Company was established in 1996 with an idea that we needed new housing choices, that it's not a one-size-fits-all world, that our demographics in this region and across the country have changed. 60% of households in the United States are just one or two people. Yet our typical single-family development is modeled on mom, dad, three or four kids, a 3,000 to 3,500 square foot new home. And in fact, that home size doesn't fit everybody. And in fact, doesn't fit many of the households in the United States today. We looked to develop our new communities as infill within already built single-family neighborhoods under innovative codes that would create median density housing choices. This approach to development has been pioneered here in the Pacific Northwest. We didn't know at the time that Third Street Cottages in Langley, Washington was going to be the first innovative land use code put in place here in the on Whidbey Island in the Pacific Northwest, but in fact in the nation this was the pioneering innovative single family code. Eight smaller size limited homes in place of what would have been four typical conventional single family homes. Our projects have received a lot of national editorial coverage and are really seen as models and pioneering single-family infill development. This brings us to Danielson Grove, which was Mike's case study, and I'm going to tie into that a little bit. Developed here in Kirkland, it was completed in 2006 under Kirkland's demonstration code ordinance that, again, was an innovative approach to land use to provide medium density single-family infill development as a demonstration code ordinance that subsequently has been put in place as a permanent code. And when I speak to jurisdictions across the region, across the country, I point to the Kirkland Code as the place to begin a conversation. This is a 200-acre site, but whatever. It's an infill site. It's in the North Rose Hill area of Kirkland, for those of you who know Kirkland. It would have been developed conventionally as 10 7,200 square foot lots, each with about a 3,000 square foot new home, resulting in an impervious surface of about 50%. Conventionally, under the innovative code, we built 16 size limited homes that ranged from 700 to 1,500 square feet each, and use a clustered approach around garden courtyards with parking on the perimeter of the site, resulting in impervious surface of about 31%. So when you're thinking about LID approaches, clustering is and size limited homes with smaller footprints is probably one of the most significant things that you can do to reduce the impervious surface on any new development site. So this is a pre-development conditions. I like to show this because there's a lot of sites around in the region in as infill in our single family neighborhoods that were overlooked by development for one reason or another. Perhaps sewers didn't serve the community at that point, and so development went elsewhere. This is actually a very big issue in our region. Sewers, there are a lot of close-in properties that could be, should be developed, but sewers are not yet. So disturbing those properties, even though they might be a mile from Microsoft. There is no sewer there, and so consequently, development cannot happen. The city of Kirkland extended sewers to the area, to the neighborhood, making the development of this property possible. It was a relatively flat site, had been partially cleared over the years. It had a small shop building on it, and some of the area had been cleared and was really just a large lawn area. One of the neighbors, the owner rather, had been storing trailers for the neighborhood. As parking, and in fact, it's been in the same ownership for more than 50 years. So a legacy land owner. This is what, I show this because this is what a conventional approach probably would have been on the property. 10 7,200 square foot lots, which is the standard zoning in the area and would have resulted, as I said, in 3,000 to 3,500 square foot new homes. That's what's typically been built in the area. And 50% in impervious surface lot coverage as a result. So the low impact approaches that we used were clustering, smaller home sizes. We retained the significant growth of firs, primarily fir trees on the property. As a result, we also had to retain the original grade. So there's a fair amount of soil export and expense related to that. That was an aesthetic decision, but it did result in a retention, a tree retention of greater than 25% on the site. We used amended soils, organic gardens are one of the hallmarks of our development. Pervious concrete, obviously, under the drip lines of trees. Michael's talked about that. Rain gardens and swales that serve to infiltrate, capture and infiltrate roof water, runoff, and reduce detention. Detention is located under the Commons building in the community, and obviously we use a lot of native plantings and drip irrigation methods. Mike already went through this, but this is a good way of showing, I think, how these swales work. And if you notice, and I'll restate this this point. The swales captured 100% of the roof water. We were able to mitigate all of the new roof surface on this site and reducing then the subsequent mulch by about half of what it would have been otherwise. Now, these a very simple system. I'll go through this in a minute. But all the roof water, say, of this home was captured and through downspouts and piped to the river lot and then infiltrated forward to another catch basin at the front of the lot, which, if water made it that far, and in our experience now 3 years into it, usually it does not, the water drops into the vault. And I'll show you some more pictures. These are also built green 4-star homes and Energy Star certified as a result. Another picture of the swale. Now, this is a 10-foot separation, which is standard, 5-foot side yards. But rather than putting a fence down the middle, making two unusable side yards, this home enjoys a use and enjoyment easement on all of the property, all the way to the side of this house. So this whole area is the private yard for this home. And we think this is a key piece to making these side yards and private yards really viable. And as a result, this home cares for the swale and the garden that is planted in it as their own side yard garden. So as a result, maintenance has been not an issue in terms of homeowner maintenance because they really do take ownership of this portion. The swale actually is planted with a variety of reeds, grasses, dogwood, and blueberries. So they all love wet feet and as a result absorb a fair amount of the roof water runoff system. They do an annual catch basin cleanup, which they've been very diligent about. And as a result, we had an inspection last year on the vault. It's like there's never been any water damage. It's 2 years into it. It's brand new. And in fact, they can't even see any water lines on the sidewall that ever had water in it. The downspouts have clean out and go underground to a rear catch basin. This downspout pipes under. This is a 12-inch plastic box catch basin like you might buy at Home Depot. Water bubbles up at the rear lot and then forward. And there's a similar catch basin at the front of the property that if water makes it that far, it drops into the vault. So the community's won a couple of awards, the 2007 AIA National Housing Award, the Washington State Landscape Architecture Award, as both the People's Choice Award and the Residential Development and Design Award, as a unique urban infill environment that creates urban community. And I also wanted to mention that 10% of the site is in a pre-development condition. So we were able to protect those groves of trees, retain the original grade, and not disturb that soil during development at all, which is tricky. You've got to plan ahead and really think about that. The gardens are all organic, and it is a member of King County's Natural Yard Care program. Some more photographs. Also, we have a single shared lawn, so we reduce the amount of sod that would be used typically. We already talked about the drip irrigation systems that we use. And that's my completion.
For questions. And does anybody have a question for any of our panelists? Yes.
Yes, Steve Foley talked about the kind of like the redevelopment and the fact that how it's through the LID in something that happened on 75 and early on. I'm thinking about, like, say, when the city looks to redevelop or look at plans for redevelopment, like, say, Torrey Lake Mall, how is I mean, that looks like just a huge generator of stormwater. I don't know if there's any contention. I can't imagine there's any water quality, but I'm wondering how some of these techniques can be incorporated into that redevelopment.
I'm not sure about the specifics. What is required of a redevelopment project depends a lot on where it is. If it's discharging water directly to Lake Washington, it doesn't need to provide detention, still needs to do water quality. If it's in, say, the Juanita Basin, you're asking about Totem Lake Mall in particular, that one is a difficult customer because it's very flat and it's on peat soils and already has a lot of high groundwater issues. So I think things like green roofs would probably be one of the best bets because there you have some area to work with. And then trying to use at least some parking lot landscape strips as rain gardens may help you out because, again, it's very flat. So detention on that site is going to be extraordinarily difficult. And so LID, the more you can do to get rid of the water before you have to detain it, the better.